Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
You know, we survey farmers as to their intention, and then we come back and we survey them to what they actually did.
Talking grower flexibility, USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer.
And I think we had some movement, at least from what they signaled their initial thoughts about what they were going to do, and then what they actually did in response to the market saying, hey, can we have a little bit more of this crop or that crop? And you know, we got a big bump in corn and wheat acres, both commodities for which we thought the market needed a bit more at the time, and both commodities for which Ukraine was a big supplier into the global market. So I think if we go all the way back to the farmers thinking about their planting of the next crop, which they're doing again now, so we go back 1 year ago, I think that they showed a lot of flexibility coming into this year.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There's going to be a lot of people in the market. There's going to be a lot of people that are producers that are going to tell you that this year was a disaster because prices did not hold up.
Greg McBride is director of brokerage with Illinois-based Allendale.
That's to be expected. Look what we've done with inflation. We've seen rising rates for the better part of the last year and a half to 2 years. Well, that was going to happen eventually. We were going to see prices come down. And unfortunately, they did come down. But if you look at the resilience of that bean market especially, we're still holding $13 beans. This is still an elevated level. Now, it's not 15 or 16 like we want it to, but it's the same thing can be said about the corn as well. Sitting near this $5 level, this is probably overvalued for what we have in the market here. You're talking about a corn crop that has 2.1 billion in carryout. There's no reason we should be sitting at $4.71 as we close out 2023. We should be much lower. So we're holding value pretty well, I would say, in these markets.
And what happens when we hear news out of the Middle East or Ukraine?
Every time we hear something that happens over there, we get excited for a few hours, and then the market backs off. We've held these levels pretty well. So the demand situation, although it got off to a very slow start for us here in the U.S., it's actually picked up. The numbers that the USDA is showing probably need to be addressed on this next report coming up on January 12th. Probably need to see about 50 million bushels increased on the corn balance sheet for export demand, maybe 10 to 15 million bushels on soybeans, and then maybe about 25 to 50 million bushels on the wheat side of things. Those are big deals. You know, you've got the Brazilian competition for soybeans. You've got the corn and the wheat competition with the Russians and the Ukrainians. And at this point, we're holding our own despite some higher prices. And I know producers are going to look at these prices and say, well, this isn't that high. It is based off of where we stand on these ending stock numbers.
And then there's cotton. And McBride admits,
this is something that, you know, you look at this cotton market, and it seems like Texas is typically working from a deficit no matter what at this point. The production weather doesn't cooperate with us. We see these numbers come back down. The Southeast ends up with a decent crop, but the production numbers come down. The overall planting numbers come down, and I think they will continue to come down at 80 cents right now. Or 81, that's still a little bit low for where guys want to be pricing. But if you look at the history of this cotton market, you get somewhere in the mid 80s to low 90s. That's a great opportunity for marketing. So we're not far off of that. And you go out to even looking at that July contract, just shy of 83 cents. We're still in a decent spot. So we'll continue to watch that for opportunities. But overall, I think that the biggest thing with the cotton market is there's a lack of understanding of whether or not we do have good export and good usage, because it seems like versus our production, our export demand is very good, but it's not driving the markets as high as it should.
Greg McBride with Allendale. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
In 2017, I did the Weather Act. It was the first major authorization bill on all of the weather programs in 20 years.
Former chair of the House Ag Committee, now chairman of the Science and Technology Committee, Oklahoma's Frank Lucas.
It's now been 5 years since, and it's time to reauthorize the Weather Act. The goal of it is to make sure that NOAA and the National Weather Service have the necessary tools to more accurately predict the weather, both short-term, intermediate, and long-term, so that will enable us, not just Aggies, but folks in the energy business, everybody in their day-to-day life, to know what's going to happen, not just tomorrow morning. Is it going to freeze? Is it not? What kind of rainfall patterns are we going to have for the next 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, or projections as far out as we can go? Because weather determines how we farm. It determines how much energy we consume. It determines the quality of life as we're driving to and from work. Now, the Weather Act builds off of the 2017 legislation by modifying and trying to modernize critical research programs that were authorized in the first act. It also codifies several new programs that deal with weather forecasting, modeling, and predictions. And one of the things that causes the administration to go spasmic, it encourages more public-private partnerships where NOAA utilizes information from the private sector as well as their own satellites to have more data, more models to work from, to be able to offer more services out there used by the commercial sector. And also, from weather radio on down, strengthens things like the emergency preparedness. So we have more warning time when we know something is about to happen, whether it is in 15 minutes or 30 minutes or a month from now. It's just, and the science committee that's doing this, which I chair, I've worked really hard in my tenure as vice chairman, then ranking member, and now chairman of the committee to try and make it function like the Ag Committee. And you know, Tony, the Ag Committee is one of those committees where we may disagree by a commodity group, we might disagree by regions, but when push comes to shove, without regard to party, we're the Ag Committee, we're doing the Farm Bill. Well, that's where we are on the Weather Act and the Science Committee. We may have different perspectives, but improving the Weather Service's ability to give us warnings is tantamount to assault. And by the way, commercial services, whether it's the TV weather person or the radio weather person, uses these resources from NOAA and the National Weather Service as a part of their predictions. So it's important to all of us.
Speaking of important, Chandler Gould is CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers on foreign land ownership.
Foreign-owned farmland, or basically a foreign country or a foreign company owning farmland, which has become a major issue at many of the state level and here in Washington, D.C. And I am by no means saying that we should allow foreign countries and companies to own a big chunk of our U.S. farmland. It's critical that we maintain and keep that land in U.S. farmers' control. But there is a very big unintended consequence if you just outright ban foreign companies or countries, and really what I'm focusing on is Syngenta, since it is owned by China now instead of the Swiss like it used to be. There are several bills here in Washington, D.C. that would ban companies like Syngenta from owning or even leasing land, and that would have a significant negative impact on wheat research here in the United States.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The Panama Canal, as a part of the international transportation system, has reduced its capacity due to the absence of rainfall.
Dr. Ricarte Vasquez is administrator of the Panama Canal.
That has led to several situations which are very complicated, but impact also the cost of transiting the Panama Canal. In order to allocate the few slots that are available and the reduced capacity that we can operate with, we have introduced a different auction systems that makes market prices determine what the cost of transiting the Panama Canal will cost. This has created a reaction in general from the industry, assuming that the cost associated with transiting the Panama Canal when available is extremely high. I'd like to point out two things about this issue. One, There is no better way to allocate supply than using market forces and prices. And the price is eventually determined by customers. And the customers have a value relationship to that price. And they make the final decision in taking the slot at the given auction price or choosing an alternative route to move the cargoes. It's not the most efficient, I have to say, but it refuels the issues about cost of landing merchandise at destination. It is not something that the Panama Canal is doing on purpose in order to max out revenues. And I want to point out that this very clear. The Panama Canal has no intention whatsoever to maximize revenues through the auction system. But it finds that there is no other way better than the market price system to allocate these resources when they are so scarce. The other element that has been under questioning is the way we allocate the slots and the reservations alongside. And we have been making adjustments with every advisory to shipping that we have issued in order to accommodate the maximum volume of traffic that we can operate with the current levels of water in our lakes. That situation, we expect that will lapse probably with the start of the rainy season come April, May next year. We did an extreme case, and we put the system to a test, making a stress condition as a result of the driest October. In Panama, October is the rain that has most of the rainfall that uses the Panama Canal. Being October, the driest October in history, led us to take extreme restrictions in order to reduce the number of traffic to overcome the official dry season that began December the 2nd. We assume at that moment, in the late part of October, that November precipitation was to be similar than that of October. Fortunately, November precipitation and rainfall was much better than we anticipated. And as a consequence, we have allowed for a larger number of transits to be scheduled for the months of January and February till conditions prevail. We continue to trace and monitor rainfall and lake levels in order to assure that we have enough water to allow 44 feet of draft that serves about 70% of the transit that use the Panama Canal. To us, market satisfaction and customer satisfaction is critical in order to handle the expectations of the shipping clients have about transiting the Panama Canal at the right time, at the right cost.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Essentially, this was a report that we have been working on over the last couple of years.
U.S. Grains Council develops export markets for U.S. barley, corn, sorghum, and related products that includes distillers' dried grains and ethanol. Alexander Grabois is Manager of Global Strategies and Trade.
Before I get started, I do want to thank the Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council, North Dakota Corn Utilization Council, and the South Dakota Corn Utilization Council. They were the key supporters in this project, and without them, a lot of this would not be possible.
Grabois is talking about the U.S. Grains Council's Corn Origins Report.
But essentially what we did in this project, we're looking to aim to benefit the U.S. farmer by improving perception on U.S. corn on a global scale. And one of the ways that we have been looking at this is by highlighting and identifying competitive advantages. So within the study, we took corn that had been re-imported, so essentially U.S. corn that was shipped overseas, we brought it back, as well as South American corn, and we conducted lab studies to essentially see how the performance would be for the broiler industry. And what we found is that the U.S. corn has a more efficient feed conversion rate. And essentially, because it was lower than that of other origins, it means that the birds that were fed this corn require less volume within the 35-day growth phase. And based on this metric, we could see that poultry operations worldwide would be able to see significant savings if they incorporate U.S. corn to their portfolio.
So how would the council actually use this report?
Essentially by keeping a lot of the conditions the same through this analysis. We were really able to pinpoint where U.S. corn performs well. And one of the things that we found through the feed conversion rate and being able to explain that through the fact that U.S. corn has a soft endosperm. So that will help play a role in that feed efficiency because it'll break down easier and the chicks can digest the corn easier. And what we find with this is that this can highlight concerns that we see from international customers on U.S. corn quality and really show what sets us apart. For example, starch extractability, and we understand that there are sometimes concerns on broken corn foreign materials. But what we're also finding is that even though U.S. corn soft endosperm does sometimes run the risk of increased breakage, performance regarding digestibility is not compromised. As a matter of fact, broken corn retains over 95% of its nutritional value. So what we're looking to do, and when we speak with international poultry operations and international customers, we're really going to highlight the increased profitability and increased savings. So as you saw in the report, savings would be about 2 to 3 cents per bird. While it doesn't sound by that like that much, when you really see the notable increases are when you get into this, essentially the numbers that many of these operations are managing on a daily basis. So that will get us into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And essentially as a next step, we are looking to get more awareness on the international side through our customers. So what we're looking to do is essentially conduct commercial trials with overseas broiler operations so that we can apply the results that we saw in the lab setting and throw them in a larger scale and really be able to verify the numbers and verify the findings so that when we continue to promote and speak with people like yourself or international customers, we want essentially our clients to understand, if I want to maximize my potential, I will be using U.S. corn.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We started down this trail in 2021 with ERP and had great difficulty in delivering the program resources. So the secretary says that for 2022, we'll rewrite and we'll make it work better.
Frank Lucas is a former chair of the House Ag Committee, now chairman of the Science and Technology Committee on ERP.
I actually brought this to his attention in a hearing some time ago that the way ERP was working was not functional. And always understand, I'm an old school ag economist. I'm an old school wheat and cattle guy from the 3rd District of Oklahoma. Resources should follow production, because farm bills are about raising food and fiber so that we can feed and clothe, take care of ourselves, and have a little extra to sell into the world market for cash. The secretary's perspective on this, or at least the language written for the 22 ERP, is much like the White House's perspective, which is dollars in the farm bill, dollars in the program, including ERP, should not follow production, but they should be allocated to you based on who you are and what you are producing. Or as they like to say up here, be socially responsible and environmentally responsible. That's maddening to me, Tony, because if you're taking money to address weather issues and conditions beyond a producer's control, but you're allocating it based on who the farmer is and what they're growing and how they're growing it, then that's defeating the whole purpose of the Farm Bill Safety Net since 1933. So we're all pushing back hard. Matter of fact, I am told from my constituents in Oklahoma that basically the local FSA offices have almost ground to a halt because a number of producers have figured out that the way the administration is working this, if you don't claim yourself to be a minority, you're going to be locked out of the program. So suddenly you have, I am told, an incredible number of people trying to come up with a way to legitimately reclassify themselves so they qualify. That is amazing and would not be necessary if USDA and DC had just handled the resources in the traditional way of doing it. So if I sound a little fired up, Tony, this ERP stuff is maddening, and it's causing people to do gymnastics to try and get the assistance that they should be qualified for. Oh my goodness.
The past 5 years have been marked by ad hoc disaster programs.
If you want to eliminate ad hoc, we have a solid basic farm bill in the 2018 farm bill, which is based on the 2014 farm bill, using the principles of crop insurance to provide protection on price swings and on uncontrollable weather patterns. but it's a voluntary program. You go in and purchase the coverage you want. Yes, it's subsidized to make it viable, but you decide if you want to participate. You decide how much you want to participate, and then you know where you stand by lowballing the funding of these programs in the funding process by the rest of Congress and the request from administrations, then we don't have enough dollars to make the programs function properly. And that's when you slide into this emergency relief program type stuff. We should not have to do this. We should address crop insurance and price protection straight up in the regular farm bill process, properly fund it, and then we'd all know what the rules are for the next 5 years. We could all play by the rules, and we wouldn't have to go down and take a $50 spit test so we could prove that somebody in our genetic pool was classified as a minority by USDA so we could qualify. That's corrupting the programs and corrupting people.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The Middle East creates a new situation that no one foresaw. This situation has included attacks to some of the vessels going through transit to the Suez Canal.
41% of total corn exports, 51% of soy exports from the U.S., and the majority of the U.S. sorghum crop is exported through the Gulf and then through the Panama Canal. Dr. Ricarte Vasquez, administrator of the canal.
In a world as today with high inflation and higher costs, any disruption at Suez will further complicate the situation in global trade and further create a worse expectations on the use of the Panama Canal and the limitations that we impose to international trade due to the lack of water. We expect that the situation in the Middle East is resolved and somehow the transit to the Suez Canal remains flawless, and we continue to serve the world within our respective capacities. Otherwise, shipping lines would like to consider the possibilities of longer route. And by doing that, that will lead to additional cost increases that will further expand the spread of inflation around international trade.
Why is this so vital? Panama Canal, most direct route for U.S. grain exports from the Gulf Coast to East Asia. Traveling at an average of 12 knots and assuming no delays, a voyage between the U.S. and Japan, 32 days through the canal. Same speed, 50 days through the Suez Canal, 54 around the Cape of Good Hope.
We have submitted our proposal to enhance for a long term the watershed of the Panama Canal. With a better definition of the Panama Canal watershed, we expect to start as soon as possible, as soon as we complete final designs, the construction of a new reservoir, which will provide more reliability to water resources here in Panama to supply the Panama Canal and water consumption for the population of the country. To us, this is of paramount importance. We had discussions with the government as how to handle this condition in the best manner, with full consideration on the social economical claims of the population that will be affected by such reservoir. To us, the Panama Canal remains competitive and has to remain reliable to international trade. And that reliability is highly predicated on the basis of having a significant amount of water available at all times. And this reservoir, which is long overdue, I have to say, because it was originally proposed with the water Panama Canal expansion, now it becomes more urgent, and we have to use at its fullest the Panama Canal capacity to assure reliability and to meet customers' expectations. We expect that in the next few years, we will allocate about $1.5 billion just to the resolution of the water problem. And also looking into all their alternatives and challenges that we are facing around the world, we will continue to support a diversified canal in order to provide additional services through the Panama Canal and its complementary services in order to make sure that this is the preferred route for international trade. More than the Panama Canal, we believe that the Panama route is critical to international trade, and we will make every significant investment that will be required in order to assure that it will remain cost-efficient, effective, and reliable for international commerce.
Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
As we look back at how farmers played the game in 2023,
the farmers showed a lot of flexibility in planting coming into this year.
Flexibility. USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says that word flexibility really applies to how producers shifted their planting plans to adjust to weather and market conditions.
You know, we survey farmers as to their intention, and then we come back and we survey them to what they actually did. And I think we had some movement, at least from what they signaled their initial thoughts about what they were going to do, and then what they actually did in response to the market saying, hey, can we have a little bit more of this crop or that crop?
In March, corn growers said they intended to plant 92 million acres to corn, but by planting time, the market signals changed. Farmers reacted by planting over 94 million acres to corn. Soybeans, farmers in March intending to plant 87.5 million acres, but decided to cut that down to 83.5, one of the biggest March to June acreage changes on record. Gary Crawford, Washington.